Welcome to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider, brought to you by IrishIllustrated.com. I'm Tim Parisa with Pete Sampson and Tim O'Malley on Monday, December 12th, and we have quite a bit to talk about. Notre Dame hoops over the weekend facing number one Villanova. Aaron Banks, Notre Dame gets a verbal commitment. The NFL draft, we had an update on that last week, and the premiere of Catholics versus Convicts on television anyway. And what came out of Irish Echoes, and Pete Sampson was the only one that was able to attend on Friday, was the naming of seven captains. But we're all very interested in just what the atmosphere is like at an Irish Echoes for a 4-8 Notre Dame football team.
I mean, it was what you would expect. I mean, it was a little bit awkward, and you know, it's a question of tone when you go 10-2 and you want to do more like a roast style thing. I think it's funny. Players love it. When you're 4-8 and you do more of a roast style thing, I think it got a little bit awkward at times. In terms of awards, DeShone Kizer was named team MVP. Brian Kelly said that was a vote of the players. We, Irish Illustrated, did our own staff awards last week, and we went with James Onuwalu for that.
Unanimously.
Yep. Unanimously, James Onuwalu. Equanimity St. Brown was Offensive Player of the Year, and James Onuwalu was Defensive Player of the Year. I think one of the things I enjoyed most about that is the access to players that we never talked to. In this instance, it was Jonathan Jones, freshman linebacker, who redshirted. He was scout team player of the year on defense. I mean, he's a guy that is going to be great to interview over the next 4 years. And he seemed to have a pretty good head on his shoulders about where things all were going. Talked to Niles Morgan a little bit. He said he is definitely coming back. Quentin Nelson, pretty much certain to come back, but I think not the slam dunk that maybe some people are making it out to be. And then DeShone Kizer, I would be surprised if he came back, not only based just on his comments, but talking to people around the program in the last 72 hours, the expectation is that he will declare for the NFL draft.
I think there's a irony of the season is the newcomers of the year will be seniors next year. I always enjoy that. For such a young team, that the newcomers will be seniors.
It was Alex Bars and Niles Morgan. Yeah, that was a...
Sometimes you have to make a way to get to honor the guys that obviously there's a lot of guys that deserve some type of recognition, like Niles Morgan couldn't be defensive player
but
of the year.
But they are always the most accurate selections.
You just need something in a way to honor them, especially as Pete's giving me the skeptical look of how many guys you need to honor on a 4-win team. But, you know, they do have these awards every year and you got to fill them out. So
yeah, and it's like I think especially in the instances of like scout team players or new guys, like, yeah, I mean, Jonathan Jones was straight up, he was like, this feels good to me. I mean, it may just be like a piece of paper that you get or like a little statue, but like this guy's been banging his head against a wall for the last 4 months. Nobody's noticed him. He's like, I don't know if the coaches like basically know who I am. And now he's like, oh, they actually noticed. This actually feels good and I can go into winter workouts with something to build on. So that's something. The captains was a surprise, not only in the fact that they named them, but there were seven of them. This actually... We were sitting around after the award show thinking of like, have they ever done this before? And we couldn't think of it. And then afterwards, I'm like, wait, they did this after BK's first year when they named Michael Floyd and Harrison Smith captains. Obviously, Floyd ended up getting arrested, and it was just Harrison Smith. Now, this year, they're
going... It bodes well for the upcoming season.
This year, they're doing seven captains there. DeShone Kizer, Quentin Nelson, Mike McGlinchey, Drew Tranquil, Greer Martini, Niles Morgan, and Austin Webster. Notable that it is not an indication DeShone Kizer is returning.
Did they make that clear Friday night?
They did. That was as soon as we were told about the captains before the show started. It was just sort of embargoed information. You can post it immediately when this is done. But please be aware that this is not an indication that DeShone Kizer is returning.
Look, when you go 4-8, you need to do something. You need to be proactive. I don't have a problem with it. And I think the choices of Kizer, Martini, McGlinchey, Morgan, Nelson, Tranquil, I mean, I think those are really good choices. I have, a bit of a problem with a walk-on that nobody knows and doesn't play, named a captain of the University of Notre Dame. That's a pretty prestigious award to get. And, you know, if he was captain of walk-ons, I understand. I don't want to make too big of a deal out of it, but I don't think an Austin Webster should go down in history as one of Notre Dame's football captains when he's never had an impact on the football program.
Well, he's a junior, so he might be a two-time captain.
Fair point.
Number 23.
But, you know, I mean, I say I don't want to make a big deal of it, right. And I am. But, you know, I kind of, having been around this my whole life, I think it's a little bit more prestigious than just handing out the guy to organize the walk-ons. But you made a point, Tim, about Mike Anello.
Yeah, I think he could have had a really good captain.
Now that was a significant contributor to the program. I guess
he's probably a top 10 player on that team, though, in 08. So, I mean, that might be part of it. But, yeah, we don't know anything about Oscar Webster.
Remember,
we should point that out. He might have naturally, but he's the leader of the walk-ons, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
He might naturally be
Charlie
really
Weiss had Scott Smith.
Yeah.
But he was a special teams guy and a scholarship guy.
And I asked Austin Webster about this on Friday. And I was like, so you see yourself as a captain or a captain of the walk-ons? And he was like, you know, I guess we'll kind of see. But there's no reason why he can't help a younger wide receiver out with route running or just like, let's go work out or let's watch some more film.
And I don't know.
I think that was really one of the points Drew Tranquil made when I talked to him was like, younger guys, people just assume that younger guys know who to ask for help, and they don't. And now, basically, you have somebody in every position group, almost, that younger guys can go and say, all right, what am I supposed to do? How do I get to, like, what's this workout about? How do I watch film? Like, what should I be eating? Like,
what's this technique? There can be a million things.
I'm really confused.
Yeah.
So I think that helps, but I get it that if Notre Dame went 11-1, we'd be like, seven captains, this is the best idea. This is amazing. Best idea. They go 4-8. Terrible idea. What are they doing?
I don't look at it that way.
Okay.
I mean, I don't look at it that way at all. I mean, you're trying to be proactive. You just had a whole shit year. I mean,
I'm with you. I agree with you. I think it's a smart move. But it's in the context of the record.
You're saying nothing.
Well, again, we said, whatever Brian Kelly decides is going to be wrong when you're 4-8. That's just part of it.
That's my point.
I had a story at the end of last week with Greg Gabriel on the NFL draft, the same candidates we talked about during the bye week in October. And I also took part in the first of several family Christmas gatherings this past weekend, and the idea was expressed to me that Kizer needs to come back. Well, the thing is, he's one of the top three quarterbacks in the draft with Trubisky and Deshaun Watson, and I mean, he's right up there. He's right up. He may be the first quarterback chosen in the draft. Does he need more seasoning in college to be a better NFL quarterback? Absolutely. Fact of the matter is, it's 2016, man, and that's not the way the game's played. He is one of the three best quarterbacks, which probably means whether he's ready or not, he's going to be a first-round draft choice.
I'm going to channel someone else and use this crutch when I ask this question, but I get this asked a lot. Do you guys think that the dynamic will be better if Kizer comes back or if they start anew?
I suspect the dynamic will be better if they start anew. That doesn't mean that their offense will be better because of
that.
It.
I don't mean
but
that.
The dynamic of the situation, you can always feel when it's time for someone to move on, and it definitely has that feel.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure if I could draw a parallel to anybody.
I was thinking
whether it be a Luke Herangode or something.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Wanted to leave, but then I couldn't. But Kizer clearly can leave.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if he's one of the top three quarterbacks, let's say worst case scenario, he goes third. That means you're bottom of the first round. You're still making
absolutely
$8 million.
So when
$9 million
says
dollars?
He needs to come back for who? You?
Yeah.
For
you? And it's what player would you describe as they really could not use any more experience or seasoning at the college level? That's pretty rare that you would look at a player and be like, this player has absolutely nothing to gain by returning. Especially a quarterback. I don't think there is a quarterback that couldn't benefit from more experience before they go pro.
Well, they're, you know what, no matter what, he does have to get to the NFL and they're going to start rehauling how they want him to play football. I mean, he's in a read option system. It's just not going to be the same thing. It's not a rip on Brian Kelly at all. It's college football. They are not training quarterbacks the same to go
but
to pro.
Interesting,
systems.
if you read that story of Greg Gabriel, talking about the reads and the route tree in the progressions and how Notre Dame runs their spread offense, it is a full field diagnostic situation for Deshaun Kizer, whereas with Trubisky and Deshaun Watson, it's half field, and so they aren't as nearly as far along in that process.
Right, and that will help, but I just think back to when Brian Kelly came in with from the pro-style offense Notre Dame had and said, we have to completely overhaul Dane Chris' footwork because it's 100% different than pro-style.
Yeah.
It has to be the same thing going the other way.
Yeah.
They're going to have to
is and always has been an issue with Kaiser.
It was hard to draw a parallel. I don't think this is totally accurate because you made the point that he can leave. Paulus coming back for a fifth year when everyone wanted Jarius Jackson to be the starter.
It's a good point.
Paulus, though, is a fifth-year new coach. Everyone's like, you know, it might be time to move on to someone. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for Bob Davies, new coach, to say, I don't want my three-year starting quarterback back.
Yeah.
That's the only one I can think of. Kaiser's better.
Yeah, that's a good parallel.
That's one I can
think of. Well, I mean, I don't think it's a direct parallel, but that's a good...
That's an example.
Yeah. No, that's an example.
And I think just statistically, it's time to move on. You look at Brian Kelly's record with young quarterbacks or inexperienced quarterbacks, whether that be Reese as a freshman, Kaiser as a redshirt freshman, Malik Zaire, Everett Golson. Those have been his best teams, or best, most winning teams, at least, because I think it forces him to run the ball. And if you have five offensive linemen back and Josh Adams and I'm not sure what to make of what's going on with Taurean Folston, because you would think that if he had asked for his relief to do a grad transfer, that would have already occurred.
Right.
I don't know if he's just going to try to catch on at a camp or something next year, go pro, but there's just a lot to work with offensively on the ground next year, and the receiving group returns, you know, two of their best three in St. Brown, who is clearly the best receiver, and then Kevin Stefferson, who has some athletic ability that I think Torrey Hunter we thought would have but didn't show to get deep. So I think you can do a lot with Brandon Wimbush next year, and I think you can force yourself to do a little bit less in passing, which is maybe a positive.
How many people have expressed to you just off the cuff saying, it's time to turn a page, Wimbush?
Most.
I think it's a majority.
Yeah, me too.
The one thing they don't think of, and I mean, it's because it's not their job to think of it, and why Brian Kelly wants Kaiser back, is when one of them gets hurt, he has the other one.
It really
is a part of it, is if Brandon Wood gets hurt, and everybody was wishing Deshaun Kaiser out the door, and then you have a real new starter.
Before we leave the NFL draft, I just want to throw in, I think, two interesting guys, and it's not going to be a great draft for Notre Dame. With or without, I mean, with Kaiser maybe number one, and after that, who knows when anybody gets picked. But interesting, Jerron Jones as a potential offensive tackle, and he has the perfect body for offensive tackle, and probably the best temperament for that, right? And then James Onwuala, who's that hybrid safety outside linebacker that they play up near the line of scrimmage. If he's in a, Gabriel said, if he's in a 4-3, how did he say it?
I read that.
No, if he's in a 4-3, they'll like him as a will linebacker. If he's in a 3-4, it's that hybrid position.
Interesting note on Jones. The last access to players, Jerron Jones, Thanksgiving week, said out loud, someone mentioned to me during recruiting that I should be an offensive tackle. I will never in my life play offensive tackle.
Well,
so he better be careful in his interviews because he said that's the only thing I don't want to do. Coming to college, if they wanted to make me a tight end, I would have done it. He was serious, too. He said he will not play.
Think about the temperament where he can be reactive as opposed
to... It's funny because he said, I have the temperament of a defensive player. No, I agree with you, but what I'm saying is he literally stood up there and announced it, not with the NFL. And I think someone just asked him, you've come a long way. People were talking about moving you to tackle when you came in. Did you ever think you'd be here?
NFL,
I was never doing that.
The NFL's going to disagree with him, I do believe. Where do you want to go from here, guys? You want to talk hoops? Really, really, really impressive performance for certainly 30 minutes of that game. Notre Dame was in control of it. Matt Farrell. I mean, my God, he just keeps getting better and better. It created a conversation between you and I during the game about Demetrius Jackson. And I mean, let's.
All right, well, I want to hear where this one goes.
I'll bring up how I started it because I think Tim said it before but I brought it to Tim. I said, look, Demetrius Jackson was an impact defensive player and a winning player because of that. Mm-hmm. Matt Farrell is a more skilled offensive player for college basketball than Demetrius Jackson is.
Here's how I would say it. Matt Farrell is better for that team
than
Demetrius Jackson. I'm not saying he's better, you know, he's a better athlete than Demetrius. I mean, that's never going to be the case. But who's better for that team, who ties that team together, who makes the players around him better.
He's so good at driving and dishing and so good at hitting pull-up shots. Now, he cannot get to the hole and get 14 free throws in a game like Demetrius Jackson can, and right, he won't go out and beat Wisconsin 84 feet away from the basket when you need to get to the sweet stuff, the Elite Eight. There's a, I was not saying he's a better player than Demetrius Jackson, but
neither one of us.
The way he runs the offense and his offensive skills, they are totally legit, because we've been looking at each other for, I think, every game we go to, and we're all like, man, he just keeps doing this, doesn't he? He's really good. And now it's just, it's automatic.
And he did
that
it against,
good
he did against
player.
Villanova. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's one thing Colorado and Northwestern and Iowa, but he did it against Villanova. And of course, you know, when the ACC starts and they're playing 18 games this year, they're going to go to 20 games. I mean, you better be good to get through that conference. Everything that he showed here, beginning with that Colorado-Northwestern back-to-back games, this guy is dynamic, man. He is a really, really good college point guard.
Another good thing that came out of that and relates to Farrell is that TJ Gibbs isn't afraid of anything, and he's a really good backup college point guard for Matt Farrell. He had no fear in that game. You know what? I mean, he's going to be a much better player in 2 years than he is right now, but he's fine to put in. And I think he'd do really well put in for a stretch if Farrell turned his ankle again. I think you're fine. You put in Gibbs. That's a nice thing. It's a shame that Colson had a rough first 25, 30. He played really well when the rest of the team didn't at the end. He was having trouble with every defensive rotation. He was pressing. I think he got some pub for being a very good national player, and he was trying to become a great player that day against Villanova. And it's hard. That's a hard transition to do. But he responded after a while. I even tweeted
he
should
did.
Come out.
I mean, he only had two rebounds in the second half. And look, they lost the game, okay? And so let's talk about when everybody's telling me that, oh, this is the best defense. We hear that every year, and I do agree. It's a better cohesive team defense. But when they needed to stop Josh Hart, and I realize that, I mean, he's good. First of all, he'll be Big East player of the year. He might be next. And that might be the least of his awards.
He's a strong dude, too. I thought that was Mike Bray's best point. He's just strong. It's the reason they couldn't stop. Pfluger's a really good defensive player against quick guards. And Pfluger had no chance of stopping Walkup last year in the Stephen F. Austin game. I think there's a little bit of a weakness. You can't put him on strong guys like that.
That was the point they made in the broadcast that Hart had put on, I think, 15 pounds in the offseason. And, I mean, that really showed, because they just guys were just bouncing off him.
Yeah, but even Vastoria was bouncing off him. He's tough. I mean, he's a senior that's pretty strong defender.
They're a long team. And so my point, and Beecham shoots 2-for-11. You know, I mean, you can't have that on the road. But they're not quite there. They weren't quite ready to beat the number one team in the nation. The big concern for me is still what happens in the paint, because Martin Gebben he had a little stretch there where he scored five and had a couple rebounds, and he is a good passer, but
and he does get in the way in the post. And I say that because Zach August didn't last year when he had three fouls. He wouldn't touch anyone, and Gebben will foul out of games. And Pete and I were talking about it. You know, what does he bring that Mooney doesn't? He's bigger. He's stronger now, and he gets it. He establishes.
He is, but I would like to see Mooney get a couple stretches in each half to just, you know, I mean, he's more athletic. He obviously has more range. I think he just has a more natural basketball court awareness.
Yeah.
But he is just a freshman.
I think he will. Over time, Bray usually likes to get those guys in at home first, because nerves strike.
Yeah.
On the road for the, I think it would have been a rough environment for him. Unless something goes great first, where you get a layup, get fouled, make the free throw, and all of a sudden you have confidence. But it's a tough, like, even putting in Matt Ryan, he looks so overmatched athletically in that game when they put in Matt Ryan. It's just not he still struggles on the road.
He needs to develop a more well-rounded game. When you go into the game just thinking, I'm a shooter, you're not going to look good in the other aspects of your game.
Yeah. I mean, to me, reminds me of like some previous Bray era players from like 5 years ago that were just really good spot up shooters, but maybe didn't bring a whole lot else. I mean, so you got Villanova, they're 9-1 now. Purdue this weekend, then a couple more non-conference games, Colgate and St. Peter's before ACC play opens. I mean, it's this probably what a 4-5 seed type of season. I mean, that's sort of how it feels. And like going into the year, I would be more in the Mike Bray, let's just get to Dayton to the play-in game. Yeah. So I've been really impressed with them overall.
You know, they're gonna get beat up a little bit on the road. I hesitate to say 4-5 seed. yet. I mean, I think they've looked like that kind of team. I don't know that they'll ultimately end up being that team.
We kind of, this is what I was kind of alluding to before the Villanova game. If you beat Villanova, you can lose some of those. You can go 11-7 in the ACC with a win against Villanova, and you are a 4 seed because everyone remembers you beat Villanova, and the committee does. They got to beat Purdue,
and they don't get that. I mean, they don't put any weight on a loss, close loss, right?
But they will if they lose to Purdue, they will, right? Two in a row, this will look. They stepped up in class. They're not. They lost two in a row. I think it's important to try.
Well, that was the thing. If you beat Villanova, and you're right, they could afford to lose to Purdue, but you would expect to beat Purdue. So if you lost, it'd be like, damn, you know, you did this, but now you took a step back. Once you lose to Villanova, you really need to win that Purdue game.
Yeah, and you'll be down there on Saturday to cover that, 2 o'clock. But that will be really interesting because it's a different matchup. I mean, that's a team with size where Martin Gemmon has to somehow stay on the court for 25, 30 minutes.
Swanigan?
What about Isaac Haas? I mean, those are two bad matchups.
They needed to get Swanigan. We got to go back in time.
Yeah. and then to wrap up segment one, Aaron Banks, the latest commitment from Notre Dame, they're back to 18 overall. Tim and I have both looked at film of this guy. He's a guard. I wonder if he could be a space-eating two-gap nose tackle if you needed him to be, but he's big. There's no question. This is a big, big dude.
He's huge, yeah. It lists at 6'7", so he's probably 6'6". Listed at 335. He looks more than that to me. The first film I saw of him, it had to be really early in his high school career, and I thought, oh my God, this guy, he can't move his feet. He has come a million miles. It has to be in the last 12 to 18 months. There might be a right tackle in there. I realize the problem's off the edge, but the way he's trending with his feet, the way he's playing lower, his knee bend is better, his waist bend is better. He's made a lot of progress in a short period of time. But if you want to maximize his ability, put his butt at right guard and let him plow people. As long as he continues to progress, athletically, he has to continue to really, really work to be in the best condition he can be.
I'm going to speak for the angry fan and say, put his butt at right guard, let him pass protect for 50 plays a game, right?
He's not going to be, as a guard, you're not going to be revealed as a poor pass blocker. And I think he has enough footwork to be a decent pass blocker at guard. Defensive tackle, Pete?
I mean, in a 3-4 purely, need somebody to like beat up centers and reach out and grab people.
But he's got to show some more lateral productivity, get off a block and make a tackle going laterally, which again, I think some of the film that Jack provided for me shows some of that, but still
that's
a lot
purely
of progress.
A scheme. Yeah, because I'm not saying he should be like, well, I wonder if he could be the next Jerry Tillery. I'm more like, could he be a Konish Schwenke senior year type of just I'm going to beat up the guy in front of me and then reach out and grab
him. I kind of look at like, okay, you're a right guard. And the next step, show me you can play right tackle. And the next step, show me you can play defensive line.
That's probably a good way to look at it.
That's the progression.
Good way to look at it. All right, that's it for segment one on Irish Illustrated. And Saturday, we will come back, talk a little more about recruiting visitors over the weekend, what's next for the football program, and fan sentiment around the interwebs and various newspapers. All that next, Irish Illustrated Insider.
Segment two of Irish Illustrated Insider is our Burning Up the Boards, and we start with a question from Zer. At other schools, it seems like beat writers usually have scores of, quote, sources. I hear about this less at Notre Dame. Please explain, what is it like covering Notre Dame from a sources perspective?
I think it's, it's not too challenging from, like, player news, but I do think from an administrative side, it's a more challenging here. And I think Zer's sort of take on this is correct, but I think a lot of it has to do with Jack Swarbrick often operates as a party of one.
Yeah.
So there's less people in the loop, which means there are less people to leak it out.
Right.
Yeah, I think administratively, it's carefully guarded. And I think Jack Swarbrick's very good at that. Now, I'm not sure that every every AD before or after will be as good at that as he is. You know, I don't know. Sometimes we we get a little bit of information coming from his area. I think maybe and you know, Pete has more sources than either one of us, but
or anyone
I
else.
Think that yeah, and I pray anyone else, but you know, I think we kind of have it kind of like our writing styles and our approaches on this podcast. I think we kind of cover the gamut of sources as well as the way we look at the program and our personalities and the way we approach it.
I'm trying to think of from the administrative point of view. You're right in that I guess it's so close to the guard, you're not going to get much bad news ahead of time other than we knew about the vacating for the better part of 4 years.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, but you know, like I had an interview set up with Jack Swarbrick the day before the cheating scandal broke, and it was canceled. So I had a pretty good idea that something was about to happen. I didn't know what, you know, but I was immediately thinking, well, tomorrow's going to be a long day because he wouldn't ever bother canceling this. And that was,
I think, a good sort of anecdotal story is like when Brian Kelly was hired, that wasn't something that broke across Twitter more than like 2 minutes before Notre Dame put out an announcement. And there was not a lot of, like, here's how the negotiations are going with Brian Kelly. Here are all the candidates. It was very locked up. I mean, it really even, I think when it comes to staff changes, there's not a lot of stuff leaking out about that either.
No, there's not.
You know, and, you know, when it comes to the defensive coordinator, look back to when Mike Sanford was hired. It was like, that came out basically moments before it was announced.
Right.
So that's... I think it's just sort of
so. This is a
tricky.
I mean, it may be frustrating for fans, but it is a good thing. It whether they realize it or not, it's a good thing that, and I. It's to Notre Dame's advantage that less people know, regardless of how frustrating that can be for us.
There's a fair amount of misinformation too. Clearly, I mean, regarding Kelly already.
You think?
Think about it. Sitting out in Manhattan Beach all of a sudden. It's like, no, I haven't heard that he's about to be fired, but I guess I'm going to have to start calling into this.
Yes.
And he wasn't about to be fired. So I know there's plenty of it. I mean, we both, all three of us immediately contacted sources that would know. They all said that they hadn't heard that. And so we clearly weren't going to be jumping on that bandwagon, but we had to keep looking into it because it made sense to me because I wrote about it a month prior. But
I do believe that there was... You know, the general theme of a very unsettled nature right after the game concluded, I do think that there's accuracy in that as well.
There's always, I think, a little bit of truth in what's going on. I mean, I think very rarely do we hear stuff from our sources that, you know, it may prove to be false in the end, but I think rarely does it prove to be, like, completely fabricated a hoax setup. So, I don't know. It's tricky here. Next up. P. Butler 2, can you please address the advertisements and the, quote, fight for excellence, end quote, group? I think that explaining away the facts by referring to their anonymous nature is bogus and seems like sidestepping of the valid arguments they present.
The valid arguments, I think, just needed to be presented during November when, you know, there's during the season. And it's over. I mean, I presented an argument twice. He's not going to get fired. I don't know if you're helping or hurting anymore because I don't think you have an impact. I think the self-aggrandizing behavior is what is off-putting for me. I think the first ad, if you would have cleaned it up for accuracy and left some of the stuff in there, I mean, that's all legitimate arguments that they have that over the course of time, Brian Kelly has had a great year, a good year, four average years, and a terrible year. So, I mean, I think there are arguments to be had. I just don't like the way they're going about it. I don't think it helps. But you know what? I shouldn't say I don't think it hurts more than it helps because I don't think it has an impact. I don't think people that want to go to Notre Dame are looking at some people that took an ad out in the paper and been like, man, those guys must have a point. I don't want to go to Notre Dame anymore. And I don't think it's helping, clearly.
No, it's not helping.
Yeah, but I mean, the point maybe isn't to help it, though, either. Like, we could, you know... We're looking at it a little bit, I guess, myopic point of view. You're not either helping or hurting. They want their voices heard, I guess, and the voices are going to be heard, and it's going to have zero impact on anything for 2017. None whatsoever.
Here's my if you're going to demand accountability, you cannot do it anonymously. That does not work. And I think that's where the whole thing breaks down, because it's hypocritical. As soon as I can see, like, wow, that's a really hypocritical point you're making. I don't really care how valid your argument is. You've lost me. And look, what's the point of an advertisement? It's to convince. It's to make an argument. It's to bring someone around to your side. And if you're going to be hypocritical about it, that's not going to happen. To me, if they had one contacted, it's like a graphic designer to work on this, and the ad was essentially everyone's name that had contributed to this, that would sway me much more than some retread statistics that have been on Irish Illustrated for months. Because to be the power of this, and I think this group has missed this point entirely, if they have a power, it is in the volume of people who are contributing, not the volume of how loud the message is, how big your font sizes are. If you had, let's say you had 5,000 names on that ad, and you could work that into, and it was just like, we fight for excellence, that would say a lot more to me than bringing up a picture of Tyrone Willingham or the Four Horsemen. They can make a good case here. They're just not doing it because they're not being smart about it.
I hate to interrupt Tim. My real point is that
that's okay.
Yeah, maybe it's better if I interrupt you right here.
Yeah.
I guess I'm looking at it. The point of view is that it's useless. This isn't going to do anything. You know how you can make an impact is that instead of getting this done in the last 3 weeks, and being proud of getting it done in the last 3 weeks, and there's more to come. If over a 9-month period, you contacted all the people that you could find that are frustrated with the situation and really believe they want a change, and all of those people, when the first game kicks off, walked out of the stadium.
That would be something.
But you're not going to do that, because you're going to watch Notre Dame next year, no matter who the coach is. And you know that, and as soon as they're 6-0, you're going to be cheering for them again. So that would be something. You put your name on something in a protest, I understand that's everybody's right to use their money however they want. The money is irrelevant to me. It's your right to protest, but if you really wanted to make a change, it's... And I know you can't say all the limiting donations, because if someone donates $1,000 a year, that doesn't, Notre Dame doesn't care. You're going to have to find the guy that donates. I'm not ripping out a $1,000 donation at all. I'm saying that you would have to have a million people to do that. You need to find the guy that donates $20 million and get him to walk out with you. But
I understand the need to say this, and I say more power to you. Go for it. But I don't know how you think you're going to impact Notre Dame by demeaning and embarrassing them, publicly demeaning and embarrassing them. If you have a group of people that approach Notre Dame, approach Jack Swarbrick respectively, and try to organize a meeting and an exchange of ideas and conversation, I think that that's more impactful than going about it this way. I just don't understand how you think that you're impacting the situation. How are they impacting the situation positively, or creating Notre Dame or putting Notre Dame in a position where they feel like, okay, now we're going to have to make a change. I just don't see that. I think dialogue with the powers that be has more power than something like this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a good approach to it if they want to do some kind of, I don't know, town hall meeting or whatever. But
I don't know that that's the way to do it. I think meeting with Jack Swarbrick, right. And I don't know how Jack Swarbrick would, and I keep using his name, but I don't know how the university would respond to that. Maybe they tried to do that and it was shot down. Right. I'm not aware of that. I don't know that. But what I do think is that when I see a full page ad in the South Bend Tribune, which is an attempt to demean and embarrass Notre Dame, I don't think Notre Dame's going to respond positive to...
Notre Dame is not going to respond they won't, positively
right?
To
so
that.
Therefore, the effort is unsuccessful because you're not creating the change that you're trying to get.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a stick in the eye. Which, like, people don't respond to that.
See, John, to move on. It has been my sense during Brian Kelly's tenure that he delegates most of recruiting analysis and visits to his staff. Conversely, often hear how active elite coaches like Urban Meyer, he is an elite coach, are on the recruiting trail. Is this an accurate perception of Coach Kelly? And have you sensed any more urgency from him in regard to recruiting following the end of the dismal 2016 season?
I think it's a fair assessment from C. John in terms of Kelly's recruiting style being more delegation and CEO approach. I also can't sit here and say that I know things have changed because they went 4-8 and what the reaction is to that. I think recruiting is still going okay. Maybe a little bit. Well, it's going better than okay. But will that change moving forward? I just don't think that we know yet. Maybe we'll learn something in the next 2 months until National Signing Day comes around with, you know, somebody like an Antoine Simmons or Josh Pascal, a linebacker and defensive end that they really want. I think that it would be a positive change. We've talked about it a bunch in this podcast, but C. John is right in terms of the way he phrases the question, but I can't sit here and say that I know things have changed appreciably in terms of how Brian Kelly is involved in recruiting.
I mean, he's been on the road like he always is, right?
Yeah.
At this time of year. Now they're in a period where they can't have face-to-face contact with recruits. I don't think, you know, we want to compare to Meyer and Harbaugh, and those guys are on an island by themselves, I don't know that Saban necessarily is as great a recruiter as those two are, but the product is so spectacular.
Must be pretty good.
The product is so spectacular that it, you know, I want to say it sells itself, but it goes a long way towards that. I don't know that Brian Kelly can convince recruits the way Urban Meyer and Jim Harbaugh can. I don't know that he's not as good at it.
At the end of the day, that's sort of what the very simple answer to this question is. Urban Meyer and Jim Harbaugh are just better recruiters as head coaches.
Yeah. Now, the effort, you would agree the effort could be greater.
Could you go about it a different way? Could you close that gap a little bit? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they've tried to be creative in the past with kind of smallish returns. But, could Brian Kelly just say, like, look, I'm going to latch on to this guy. I mean, in the case of Niles Morgan, it's a fair one to bring up. He was basically his primary recruiter, but only because his area recruiter, Chuck Martin, left for Miami, Ohio, and his position coach, Bob Diaco, left for Connecticut. And then Notre Dame closed the deal on that pretty quickly. So, I mean, Brian Kelly, I think, could be really good in a living room.
Yeah, I would think so.
I think it's maybe some more of the tenacious grunt work aspects of it that Urban Meyer eats, drinks, sleeps recruiting. I don't like that's just not, I think, Brian Kelly's approach on it.
He's got more to sell too right now. It's just the way it is. I mean, Urban Meyer convinces Notre Dame coaches to come to his staff. He convinces Notre Dame recruits to come to his team, and he's whatever he is, 65-5.
Yeah, many. Wins.
I mean, Brian Kelly had a lot to sell after 2012.
He did,
and there's only been really out of the last four seasons only one.
Yeah,
you're really proud of.
People don't want to hear it, but he's a legend. And when Urban Meyer came to Notre Dame's coaches clinic, Tommy Rees, who was the starting quarterback for Brian Kelly, said, "I can't believe I get to talk to Urban Meyer."
Yeah,
I mean, that's just
that says it all.
It's Urban Meyer for you.
That says it all. D.L. Barron, you mentioned this in passing in another thread, but share your thoughts on why and how Notre Dame perpetually burns red shirts by playing freshmen on kickoff and punt teams. Take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, This is one of those questions that I would like to ask not only Brian Kelly outside of a press conference, but Jack Swarbrick as well. Is just, what's the goal here? Are you trying to play as many freshmen early so you can say you play as many freshmen early in recruiting? Or are you trying to be older and think long term? And it seems like it's much more the former, because Romeo Okwara sacked Dak Prescott last night in an NFL game and finished with 8 tackles in his first career start. I think he would have been worth at least 3 wins last year. You look at Kona Schwenke, Romeo Okwara, those are the big ones to me.
There's 2 new ones.
Now you unfortunately have Julian Okwara and Khalid Kareem that came through this year, and you're just like, what was the point of that? I don't get it. I think that Kelly has expressed some frustration, which I think is illogical, about Matt Hegarty. He will about Malik Zaire. Like, well, what was the point of redshirting? Because they just left. Well, what? I don't get that. Like, it's in the best interest of the player, then, that they go play somewhere else if they're not going to play here. And the fact that you lose a backup to another school doesn't mean you should eliminate the chance of having a fifth-year starter down the road. Because you look at their fifth-year starters next year, McGlinchey, Nelson, okay, offensive lineman, redshirt all the time. And then it's McGovern, Bivin, okay, you redshirt offensive lineman all the time. And then probably Durham Smythe. That's it. That I just think you could do a better job with your roster at that point than to have four or five fifth-year seniors.
It's interesting. I wonder if Isaac Rochelle would come back for a fifth year if he hadn't played those spot plays in 2013.
I would think he probably would.
Yeah. They might have needed him a little bit more than they did Aquara and Schwenke. You know, I put the Aquara right up finally on the board because there's a new thread about Aquara for the 100th time. I actually just answered what happened, so if you want to go read it on the site. They panicked a little bit. They felt they needed to play him because they lost Spahn for 2 weeks. And anyway, but Brian Kelly's even said afterwards, they basically needed a backup linebacker at the position, and they chose him, but they threw him out there on kickoff coverage. And Brian Kelly even mentioned, like, use Romeo Aquara by name, saying, you know, some guys just, they don't have a feel for it. You should have seen him trot down the field and aimlessly. Well, why did he win your starting job there? Which might explain some things from this year. But, you know, they feel the need once the guy gets in the two deep, I think, to give him a taste. And I guess that's not the best idea for, obviously not for, they don't do this offensive lineman very often, but defensive lineman. Even Julian Aquara, I think they thought he would help with pass rush this year, but they never gave him the opportunity to really help with pass rush. They kept putting him down, running down on kickoff coverage against Adoree Jackson, and that's not the use of his career that you need. It's amazing they're doing it to another Aquara, actually. And the Khalid Kareem makes no sense to me, because you got to develop him to be strong enough to compete there. If you need spot snaps, that's Jonathan Bonner behind Isaac Rochelle. That's Jay Hayes.
Right.
You had no reason to play him. Julian Aquara is, they probably thought, we don't have a pass rush. Maybe he can give us one. So I guess I understand why he was prepared to be a player. And once you put him in, he's a good athlete and you're kind of stuck. But the Kareem one is the worst of this year. Kona Schwenke was a total panic move. It was ridiculous as a sophomore. He gained 60 pounds in the offseason. It wasn't physically...
To not even beat Purdue.
They won by 30 points. Yeah. And you're putting him out there because you had a guy suspended for a game.
Yeah, because it's upon to a good play.
You can understand it more if, like, then in their sophomore year they play, they're a starter and they're a significant contributor.
Yeah.
And then it's a little bit understandable.
Took Aquara four. All four. To be a guy
right,
where you're
exactly,
like, wow, he's really
exactly,
developed.
Exactly. So if Khalid Kareem suddenly bursts into the starting lineup next year and is a legitimate starter and player, okay, well, then you can accept it a little bit more. But that doesn't happen enough.
Every once in a while, you have guys, and I believe this of Ishaq Williams, if you don't play him as a freshman, you might lose him. I think that happens on occasion. I think that's why they ran Nick Watkins on kickoff return as a blocker. Now, he got his ear back from injury.
Yeah.
But they literally put Nick Watkins out there. Never played a snap in a scrimmage. I mean, he never didn't make a tackle on kickoff coverage. It's a weird
They
dynamic.
Need a better plan. They definitely need a better plan.
And I don't think it should be attached to special teams, because you keep complaining about how many freshmen you have on special teams. Quit playing them.
Well, the biggest problem with special teams is you can't sell it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
They can't sell it
that's
as being...
But it's
I mean, just like this freshman class, like Javon McKinley, I think we all agree that receivers and I to a certain extent corners. So, and when you mentioned Nick Watkins, just I'm okay with playing young guys at receiver and corner and running back, because you're probably going to recruit somebody just as good. There's
fifth-year guys aren't good. You don't have good fifth-year receivers, running backs, and corners that didn't get hurt, is the way to say it. Like, Remo McKnight would not have... He didn't redshirt. He got hurt as a senior.
Right.
Sierra Wood
so
left.
I mean, it's like, okay, you redshirted Tony Jones. That's great. You know, is Tony Jones going to be a fifth-year player here? Probably not, based on the number of fifth-year seniors that have been at that position. But Julian Aquara, Jameer Jones, Spencer Perry... you know, you could throw Khalid Kareem in there, obviously, that we've talked about. And then Javon McKinley as well. Like, those are guys that never really had a chance. And there wasn't a need. They didn't have a rash of injuries at those positions.
I think you could tell. I think when we went to Culver and watched McKinley practice one time,
we knew
he was a long way away.
Somebody was going to be the ninth receiver. You didn't need to play him. Stefferson was obviously way ahead. And Chase Claypool was just built differently than everybody else.
The thing is, they don't play, you know, you want all these receivers because you have, you know, three wideout spots on the field. But unless somebody gets hurt, they don't ever come off the field. No, so you don't use your depth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, but I mean, like, Jalen Elliott, that was a great use. I mean, I realize it didn't work out.
Right, you had to play him.
That was a smart play, even though he didn't play a ton on defense. I get that. I mean, the obvious ones, look, Julian Love, Stepherson, you know, Claypool was, that's totally fine.
Yeah, he made a significant
saw real reps. He did something. You know, Dante Vaughn, yes.
Well, Chase Claypool was obviously one of your best special teams players.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a guy you had to have out there on special teams. That's not burning a year.
Right.
That is, you can't, there's people often talk out of both sides of their mouth. Why are we burning a year on special teams? Why do our special teams stink? You need your fastest, strongest guy out there on
that's
special
utilizing
teams.
An asset.
Yeah,
is what
Chase
that
Claypool
was.
Is helping your special teams. Javon McKinley was burning a year on special
teams.
Yeah,
that's a good call.
I think that's probably a good way to look at it.
Where are we at?
J-Law 1 with Fickle taking the Cincy job. Do you think Urban comes after Elston as well as Sanford? If he did, which would be the bigger loss?
Urban comes Urban comes after everybody.
He's a machine.
Guys, I'm leaving to go cover Ohio State. I got a call from Urban Meyer this morning. I think Mike Sanford... That would be, well, also Alabama's in the market for offensive coordinator. And what...
No one can win there, though, like, when you make that move.
Like, what jobs are tracking you for a head coach more than Ohio State and Alabama right now?
So he absolutely has to be named the play caller at Notre Dame for him to stay.
Mike Sanford, I would say yes. And I think, like, and it wouldn't just be a defensive move. It would be like, hey, this would be a good thing for our offense. Like... Regardless of what was happening.
It shouldn't have taken Alabama and Ohio State's interest.
Come to this. He is not looking to leave, Mike Sanford. But he will leave if Urban Meyer and Nick Saban offers him the offensive coordinator job and Brian Kelly doesn't offer him the play calling offensive coordinator job. And so would everybody listening to this.
Oh, my God.
Right now. I mean, it's clear.
Yeah, and that would be a real shame because we never...
All right, but who's the bigger loss? Because Mike Elston was our unanimous... Assistant coach of the year, right?
Yeah. Well, he was, yeah.
Yes, he was, but Mike Sanford didn't have a chance to be.
No, exactly. No, I understand that. I understand.
I think, you know, I'd probably go Elston.
Because he's recording coordinator and it's.
Because he's recruiting coordinator and there's multiple.
And because we have no idea how good Sanford would be as a play caller?
Yeah, we don't. Sanford is still. There's a lot of potential there. We know he's a really good quarterbacks coach.
Elston, he's like a backup quarterback.
Yeah,
right
Elston,
now.
I think you look at and think, okay, good linebackers coach. I could be good.
I thought the linebacker, yeah, that
was
one of the best. Yes.
Yeah. Recruiting coordinator is good. You know, is it Vinny Serrato? No, but it's good. He's an asset to what you're doing. Like, Notre Dame getting back on track, I would say that Mike Elston and Mike Sanford are both part of that solution.
I agree.
So they would both be losses. Now, Mike Elston wants to be a DC somewhere. And he wants to be a head coach eventually somewhere else. Could he make a move similar to Tony Alford to be like, you know what, I've hit a plateau here where I'm sort of seen as like a support assistant coach opposed to a lead assistant coach? Maybe. I mean, I think you'd have to at least evaluate that.
Assistant coaches get poached off of 65-5 staffs pretty quickly. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Urban Meyer's assistants, you say, they must be doing a great job because they never lose games, so let's give them a job. It's totally natural.
Play young players, they have no problem. You know, with Elston, I think one difference from Sanford and Alford is that Mike Elston, I think, has been with Brian Kelly for 13 years. So that's a big difference. I can tell you that he is also not looking to actively leave Notre Dame. Just based on his comfort level here.
I think I agree with that they both kind of get snubbed if they don't get play calling and coordinator jobs at Notre Dame. That's what it is. I know Mike Sanford's the offensive coordinator, but if he's not the play caller, it's a snub. And if Mike Elston has to be retained on the staff and is not the defensive coordinator, it's hard for him not to think that.
And what's the reaction going to be if Mike Elston is named defensive coordinator?
That's an interesting way to look at it because it's like, okay, how big of a loss would it be for Elston to leave to be DC at Ohio State? I think a big loss. And then how much of a gamble would it be for Brian Kelly to name him defensive coordinator?
Also
a huge gamble. So, I don't know. He's in a tough spot. I don't know if you can do a Denbrock type of situation there. And can you have an assistant head coach and an associate head coach?
Hell yeah.
Why not?
That's why they came up with associate.
Titles. Just give them out.
Make him an
at least put. I think you have to. You have to put Elston in more of a leadership role next year. If that is defensive coordinator, that's a gamble. But he's got to have more say and more input about what you're doing in the program.
Yeah. Does the title actually give you that leadership, or do you just make more money?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably both. Yeah.
It's okay to make
both would be good.
Buffalo Irish one. Which freshman needs to make freshman with an A, not an E? Which freshman needs to make the biggest jump in their second year? I say that because if
I was about to name 11.
God, if it was only one, if it was only one freshman that needed to make a huge jump.
So if there's one, I'd say Daylon Hayes. One. Daylon Hayes has to become one of the three best players on the defense next year because they need a pass rusher.
Oof.
They can't get anywhere near an opposing quarterback to influence a play to end poorly for the offense. You need Daylon Hayes to make a play. If you're adding to that, I would just start going on the front seven with Khalid Kareem, Julian Aquara. I don't know, name the rest of them.
I've got nine names down here in eight homer defense.
Either Jalen Elliott or Devin Studstill has to be on that list. You know, Troy Pride and Dante Vaughn and Julia Love all need to keep improving, but they need to get a pass rush. And failing the pass rush, Khalid Kareem needs to become a really good football player.
I'm going to go outside the box then and give the combo Eichenberg-Kramer, because if one of those makes a huge jump and can become your starting right tackle, then Alex Bars becomes your starting right guard, and then your offensive lineman looks a little bit more athletic, probably powerful. And I think you just have better fits at all five positions than you did this year.
You've improved two positions, you're right, if you do that. Yeah. And that's...
You know, we're all looking on the defensive side of the football.
Because you do that,
except for the offensive
linemen.
We're looking at trenches and defense. But, I mean, obviously, I know Pete definitely wants to see Claypool really emerge at receiver next year. And I think he has an opportunity, a chance to do that.
Yeah, we have some Twitter questions. The first one is from Matt Miller, and he wants to know, what was the most interesting part to you about the 30 for 30 Catholics versus convicts, and what was the most surprising part?
You know, I lived this, I worked it, and I feel like, man, I missed a lot while that was going on. I didn't know, I mean, I wasn't really aware of all the thing. I was aware of the shirt, certainly, but I wasn't aware of all the drama behind the scenes. But I guess the biggest surprise for me is the captain of the basketball team, Joe Frederick, was front and center involved in this. What would happen today if that were the case? What would happen?
I mean, if Steve Astoria put out a shirt, it's kind of hard to get your head around that happening, isn't it? I mean, Matt Farrell would be like, oh, I could see Matt Farrell doing that.
But the personalities of Vestoria compared to Joe Frederick, who is very outgoing as he is still today.
Yeah.
I mean, that couldn't happen today.
No, I only knew about that because I interviewed Joe Frederick a couple years ago for something different, and he offered to me that 30 for 30 was coming out, and I found it odd that he offered that to me, and then he told me his big part in it, and his backstory.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, this is interesting stuff.
But that's not the basis for the question. I mean, I think people are looking more towards the football aspect of it.
Yeah, probably.
I saw it in October before the Miami game, and I had no idea that pass was incomplete.
I covered the game, and I didn't know it was incomplete. But as I was saying before we went on the air, that was, for those that are younger and are only familiar with instant replay, there was no instant replay. There was no thought of instant replay. So you didn't dwell on... They didn't keep showing the same play over and over again, saying, oh my God, he didn't catch it. You just accepted it. I know it seems impossible now that we did, but that was just the way. It's real to touchdown. You move on to the two-point conversion.
Which is why it was a fumble.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot of gray area with that call anyway, but, you know, Miami had, like, if it was the other way around, Notre Dame fans would be just as vociferous about saying it wasn't a fumble.
I think my favorite parts, I liked Eilers talking about the pregame speech and getting choked up and getting up to leave the interview and saying game over when Pujols gave the speech. I totally forgot about this, but I do remember it happening. That Digger ran up the score at Miami in basketball is the greatest thing he's ever done. That is hilarious that he beat them by 53 when Miami beat them by 51. Yeah. It was a month later. That, I mean, of all the charitable works that guy has done, that is the best thing Digger Phelps has ever accomplished by doing that. Can you imagine that today? On Twitter, people would go crazy. if somebody was just murdering an opponent and kept all their guys in dunking at their stadium.
Yeah, I mean, it harkened back to a time where everyone wasn't so damn offended.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I look at, I was working for the 88 Miami game, and I was working for the 93 Florida State game. And they were, I mean, I have a difficult time saying that the 88 game was bigger. I understand because of the emotion toward Miami.
Hatred was made it.
But the week of Florida State, I was at Lou Holtz's. This is just impossible. This is impossible.
I almost don't believe you.
I was at Lou Holtz's house the night before the Notre Dame Florida State game. I was in his basement with Regis Philbin and all these people the night before.
In a professional, like, sort of media gathering,
yeah,
right?
I mean, that is impossible. That couldn't possibly happen. I don't know where Brian Kelly's house is, and I never will.
I have 365 days to find it. So, the one thing I would throw on that, you know, the Florida State, and we're really getting off topic here. Florida State, the week before the game, Sports Illustrated's week before the game preview, the cover was Notre Dame Florida State is next week.
Oh, wow.
So the cover of Sports Illustrated coming out before the game was previewing Notre Dame Florida State. I still have it. So then they were on back-to-back covers.
And I can remember, you know, and again, the whole media aspect, I mean, the whole week was just jam-packed. Well, you know how my memory is. But I mean, it seems like I remember, like, it wasn't like post-practice. It was like during the day. Like, they were interrupting the schedules of the players to meet with the media through the week.
I enjoyed the clips of the Miami-Michigan game, because growing up in Michigan, I was 11 years old. I actually remember watching that game and how pissed off Michigan fans were that I knew. So that was kind of cool. And I love the anecdote about them going there and, like, throwing a shirt in the locker room. I didn't even care if that happened
right,
or not.
That's
it was
amazing.
Just a good story. So there was, I really liked how the Miami players came off in it as well. Cleveland Gary, Leon Searcy, Steve Walsh. I don't know if I'm forgetting anybody, but, like, I just sort of liked the tone of the whole documentary, because one of the things around Notre Dame that can happen is everything is so heavy and serious. And this was fun.
Like, right, it was.
It was just sort of a fun look back at something that was, like, crazy hot. And just, there was so much hatred and seriousness back then. You can look back now and be like, man, that was a good time.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that tone of the way the story was told.
Yeah.
And I think the only game since Florida State that's anything like that, and you guys will both attest, because Pete, you had not just started, but 4 years in, was USC.
That
week,
too.
You have to have hatred. Wasn't the same level of hatred, but their excellence was there. There was a level of excellence. I feel like Florida State was the one year, they were good for a while, but they seemed like the one year team where Notre Dame fans thought, you know what, we can beat Florida State. The Miami and USC ones were just like, this is going to be...
Yeah.
Even though Notre Dame was like a 4-point underdog to Miami in that game, it seemed like a seismic upset because Miami had been so good for so long. And that would have happened if they beat USC too.
Yeah.
It would have. But you don't get many of those games.
You know, I don't know.
That's why they're so good.
So they're the games of the century.
Yeah. All right. We're actually going to wrap it up there. We've got some other Twitter questions. We'll save those for next week as our podcast. I think we're hitting about the hour mark here. So I'm getting the hook from Jack Freeman, our producer. So until then, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, Pete Sampson, you've been listening to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. We will be back next Monday.
Send your complaints to Jack.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay.